This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech at friendsintech.com.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video. Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here are your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Welcome to Technorama. I'm Chuck Tomasi, and with me is my co-host Craig Stapp. If this is your first time joining us, I'd like to welcome you to a special edition of Technorama. If you're a returning listener, then we thank you for returning. You see, normally we do a weekly show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. But we have a special treat for you this time. Craig and I have the privilege of talking to Grant Imahara of Discovery Channel's Mythbusters. We'll talk a bit about his work with Adam and Jamie, but we're also interested in finding out how he got there and where he's going. Along the way, we may also uncover some secrets. So it's my pleasure to introduce our special guest, Grant Imahara. Welcome to Technorama, Grant. Hey, we are big fans of Mythbusters and appreciate all the hard work you do.
Definitely.
Oh, well, thanks a lot. It's a pleasure talking to you today.
Now, I use this first question in all friendliness. You seem to be the technical geek of the Mythbusters team. Tell us about your background and what technical schooling you have that led you in this direction.
Yeah, well, I think that we're probably all geeks, but I'm the most technical of the geeks. And, you know, I think that pans out professionally as well. I have a degree in electrical engineering from USC, and I used my electrical engineering skills to get a position at Industrial Light and Magic doing animatronics and miniature lighting and basically anything that lit up or moved in those movies. I had some involvement in.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I think everybody knows ILM from the Star Wars movies and many other things.
What kind of projects have you worked on before Mythbusters that people may recognize?
Okay. Yeah, before Mythbusters, while I was at Industrial Light and Magic, I did, I was there for about 9 years. And the movies I worked on were, Star Wars Episodes 1, 2, 3, AI, Galaxy Quest, a lot of sci-fi type movies, which, you know, are fun to work on.
I bet Star Wars had to be like the ultimate geek job, though.
Oh yeah. Star Wars was the fanboy dream come true. Speaking from personal experience, you know, as a kid who stood in line outside of the Man's Chinese Theater in 1977, you know, with his mom, watching Star Wars on the screen, I really could not conceive of having that dream come true, you know, to actually work on the Star Wars movies, let alone the robot icons of those movies, R2-D2 and C-3PO.
Yeah, because I did not realize that you actually worked on R2-D2 as much until I was looking through your bio. I was like, whoa. I said, oh, that's like, I'd pay good money to do that myself.
Only one of three yeah. people allowed to drive them.
That's right.
Yes. It's funny because the way I got into the model shop, actually, at Industrial Light and Magic, was through the archivists, Don Bees and Nelson Hall, who are, coincidentally, the other two guys in the United States who are officially licensed to drive R2-D2. And we became friends because I was working at another division of Lucasfilm called THX.
Right.
So first job out of college was blowing up loudspeakers and amplifiers for the THX group.
I'm seeing a theme through your career.
Yeah, charmed career life. So yeah, blowing things up there led to blowing things up later on in life.
That's right.
But they were the people who got me into working into the movies and into working specifically on R2-D2 and becoming one of these drivers.
That's awesome.
The thing is, over all of the appearances that R2's require, like when a new movie comes out, there's a lot of commercials, mm-hmm. a lot of personal appearances, theater openings, and so it got to the point where there were R2-D2 appearances required all over the country, and a lot of them at the same time.
Ooh.
They said, well, we better teach somebody else how to do this so we could, you know, cover everything all at once.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then it was also really helpful being someone who knows radio control and knows electronics, in case something went wrong, I could just jump right in and say, oh, okay, well, this servo burnt out. Let's replace it with another one. It just became sort of a natural fit that way.
Right. And you know what's funny is this weekend, as a matter of fact, the other DVD I brought is Beneath the Dome. And I, as I was reading your bio, I went, he was in Beneath the Dome. And I went and pulled it up, and I was like, sure enough, there you were, right there beside the treadmill. And we all laughed about it. So is that like your first like appearance on the camera type thing? Or?
Let me think. I think at that time I had already been on BattleBots on Comedy Central.
Yeah, of course. Okay.
So, I had some camera experience.
Yeah.
That was Beneath the Dome was kind of fun because that was Don's idea while he was puppeteering First Unit on one of the Star Wars films. Oh, you know, it'd be neat to do kind of like a VH1 documentary, but from R2's perspective.
Right.
So that was kind of his pet project. And all of his friends, me and Nelson and his wife and Steve Sansweet, who also works at Lucasfilm, and Fawn Davis, who works in the model shop with me, we were all recruited to be background characters in that film. And it was, tremendous fun, really.
Well, how did you get involved with the Mythbusters?
I got involved with the Mythbusters through Jamie, pretty much. I'd known Jamie for many years prior to Mythbusters. We used to, he used to do BattleBots, and I actually met him, formally met him the very first time when he came to ILM to do a commercial for Fox Sports Net. And it was a couple of animatronic gophers.
Mm-hmm.
And so ILM didn't have, we were really slammed at the time working on many other projects and commercials. So Mark Anderson, who was running the shop at the time, knew Jamie and called him up and said, hey, could you come and work on one of our crews? Of course, Jamie had his own shop, M5, where he did commercials and mm-hmm. movies and things like that. But it was just a sort of a professional courtesy, because we all knew each other in the Bay Area community.
Sure.
So he called him up, said, could you come over, work for a couple weeks? You'll get a puppeteering gig out of it, and we'll get a couple other puppeteers here at ILM. So
sure.
Jamie shows up at ILM, and prior to that, the only experience that I had with Jamie was from Robot Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, his robot Blendo was the most feared robot in all of robot combat.
I have a feeling where this is going.
Well, Let it be said that I had kind of seen him, and he was a very intimidating character, and what a lot of people don't know is that even before Mythbusters, the mustache and the beret were a part of his everyday wardrobe.
He was born like that, right?
Well, yeah, there are actually baby pictures with baby Jamie.
Yeah. The mustache
with
and
the mustache
and beret. Actually, he was created in a lab, really. But anyway, so yeah, mustache and beret were part of that look, even from way back. So Jamie shows up at ILM, and at that time I'd been there for probably 2 years. So I'd become an established radio control guy. So I come up to it was Jamie. Jamie approached me. Because these gophers that we're working on are all animatronic. It's like,
Well, I hear you're the local animatronics expert. I said, well, not really. I guess I'm just the lapper with the most fingers. And he started giggling, like, maniacally. And that sort of set the tone for our relationship for years to come. And, you know, we shared this common interest in animatronics, and robotics, and combat robots. So he'd call me up, you know, say, on the weekend to come over to M5 and, you know, play robots, essentially. Show me, like, you know, what projects he had going on.
Yeah.
And eventually, I would work for him on nights and weekends when I wasn't working at ILM.
Mm-hmm.
If he had, say, a special project that required some, you know, an animatronic specialist. So I'd come in and kind of close up a project for him and then, you know, move on.
This is Adam Savage from Mythbusters, and you're listening to Technorama with Chuck and Craig.
So flash forward to 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
2 years ago. So flash forward to 2 years ago. Jamie calls me up and says, you know, I'm on the show. And the funny thing is, I have to admit, before being on Mythbusters,
right,
it was really hard for me to watch Mythbusters.
Oh, really?
Really?
It's like, yeah. And you would think, well, you know, you're a technical guy, you work in a similar, in this industry, it would be a natural fit. But, you know, I've known Jamie and Adam for so long that watching them on TV on this Mythbusters show was really very strange because it's like them, but it's almost a little bit like a caricature of them as well.
Oh, interesting.
You know, for the purposes of TV,
right?
You know.
Yeah.
But the other thing that made it difficult to watch the show is that it is a lot of the same kinds of skills that we use when we normally do special effects.
Mm-hmm.
The problem solving and, you know, going through different prototypes and trying to figure out how to make something do something. And watching that, you know, it felt like, oh gosh, I think I have to fill out a time card after watching that show. Because,
you know, it's
just like being at work. So it wasn't that entertaining for me.
Well, that, how has Mythbusters, how has it changed you? Because I noticed when I first saw you come on there, and I watched the show from day one, really, and I noticed that you, at first I thought you seemed a little shy at first, but actually I think you were more eager just, well, let's start working on it, and instead of really talking as much as all of you guys do on the camera now, you know, describing what you're about to do. It seemed like you were just ready to get in and start digging in.
Oh, it's really a weird adjustment to have a camera crew following you around 4 to 6 hours a day, every day, and watching all of your joys and all of your failures, and then having that be edited together and broadcast all over the world.
Sure.
I mean, before, when I would work at ILM, you know, say something didn't quite come out as you expected it. Well, that's what the bottom shelf of your workbench is for.
Yeah.
You can just slide it right under there. No one would ever know.
That's right. I do that all the time.
So, but here on the show, when something doesn't quite come out exactly as you planned, perhaps, they're all over you. I'm like, oh my God, why isn't it working, Grant? Like, I don't know. You know. So really, the show is helping me to get in touch with the feeling that it's okay to fail.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's okay occasionally to look like an idiot, because this happens in real life. But it was a very difficult adjustment. And plus, everything that you do takes twice as long.
Oh, yeah.
Because the camera crew wants to see the process, and the show is really about the process. So if you're going to, say, cut a piece of wood, like, okay, wait, hang on,
camera has come up to speed. Okay, oh wait, there's a truck backing up outside. The sound person says, just wait a minute. And, okay, wait. Somebody walk through the back. Hang on. Okay, now we're ready. Go ahead and cut the piece of wood. 2 seconds. And then, okay, thanks. Really, it's quite an experience.
What has been your favorite myth to work on so far, and why?
I really like to work on the ones where you're actually surprised by the result. And a lot of times, you'll hear a myth, and of course, every myth has a little element of truth in it.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them, we hear it, and you just develop an idea about it, and you're like, there's no way this is ever going to work. And one of those is called Chinese invasion alarm. And the deal is that supposedly in ancient China, they had an early warning system for an attacking army that might be trying to tunnel under your castle wall.
Mm-hmm.
The system consisted of a 15-foot, roughly 3-foot in diameter hole dug into the ground with a drum placed at the bottom. And supposedly, a person with good hearing at the top of the hole would be able to hear the sounds of the army, like their pickaxes or whatever they were using to dig, tunneling under the wall. There's no way this is going to work. A drum at the bottom of a hole would be a good enough amplifier of these sound waves. So we go to this gold mine, an abandoned gold mine here in California, in gold country. Jamie and Tori are down in the mine, hammering away with their pickaxes. Carrie and Adam are at the top of the hole, trying to listen for those sounds coming from the drum. I've got microphones down in the tunnel, microphone down where the drum is, a geophone, which came from the U.S. Geological Survey. It's kind of a microphone for the ground. It actually has a spike that goes in the ground. I'm listening to this entire array of super high-tech equipment, expensive microphones, the whole nine yards. On those microphones, I really couldn't hear anything. I could maybe barely make something out in the geophone, but nothing significant.
Right.
So I'm looking over to Carrie, sitting at the top of the hole on the surface. She's got her ear down to the hole, and I'm watching her finger. So I tune in to the sounds down in the tunnel, the actual pickaxes, and I'm watching her finger, and it's beating out a perfect rhythm with what they're doing down the hole. And
wow.
It's just like, there's no way that could possibly work, but it does.
Well, in a way, it kind of makes sense, but...
And if I remember right, Adam is stone deaf.
Yeah. And the thing is, right, he's really, out of the entire crew, the worst possible choice for someone to listen for something. But sort of like, well, you know, I've got the electronics, I've, you know, got all that set up. I mean, the guys are down in, you know, the strong guys are down in the cave hammering on the rock, and, well, you know, he's got to do something.
Yeah.
He's enthusiastic.
Yeah.
But, you know, and it's a good kind of contrast because, you know, I go, okay, well, how did it work? And he's like, didn't hear anything. And Carrie's like, I heard something. So you get to see, you know, oh, actually, Carrie, yes, does have good hearing, did hear something. So that is probably my favorite myth that we've done so far. And there are two or three that were equally surprising, but those are the ones that I like. The ones where you just go at the end and you're like, wow, that was true. Not everything we do is busted.
Well, listen, I got to ask you this. Just between us three here.
And all your listeners.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, them. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What drives you nuts about Adam?
Let me tell you a little thing about Adam, which is kind of amusing. So we worked together at ILM for many years, probably 6 or 7, I think. And Adam, even before he was on a television show, would run around our shop at top speed, you know, saying all his amazingly funny things as if the camera crew were actually following him. So in reality, he was really the perfect choice to be a TV character. But even back then, he was a character. And so, much like Jamie, it's not really a character he developed for the show.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they are. But just like on the show, sometimes, you know, Adam will go at light speed. I mean, at a professional model shop, speed is of the essence.
Mm-hmm.
It's the old adage is true, time is money.
Sure.
And so if you can build a model quickly, you can save money and get it out there faster. And that makes you more attractive for the next job. But at a certain point, that amount of speed sometimes becomes a little dangerous. And sometimes when Adam's working at the shop, you just kind of have to get out of the way. Because he will fly through the shop, you know, cutting things and drilling things. Okay, I'm just going to be over here. You do your thing over there. Hopefully, you won't run me over.
You know, that makes sense because it seems like Adam is, like you said, the guy that wants to hurry up and get into it, and Jamie's the thinker.
Yes, that's absolutely true. Jamie is definitely the guy who will plan it out. He will think of all the different possibilities, gather up the right materials. Adam, on the other hand, will use whatever is available that will probably work and somehow magically find a way to make it work. They are very different styles of building things.
Right.
And yet, I think that one of the reasons the show works is that you have these contrasting styles. And so it makes it interesting to see how, you know, Adam will go through and try something and doesn't work, and then Jamie says, well, I've been thinking about this, and let's try this.
You know, every time I see an Adam do Jamie's voice, I see him doing the fingers. Are you doing that too?
Yeah. Yeah, as we're here on the phone, wow. It helps do the voice.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Like Zoidberg.
This is the craziest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah. I mean, that was something that, you know, I came up with a long time ago, and Adam appropriated for the show. But he has since owned up to it. And we have lots of variations, you know, just a standard Jamie, and then Jamie, you know, the mustache kind of twitches, you know.
Monday Jamie, Tuesday Jamie.
Yeah. Yeah. You Jamie opens up his closet and just a row of white shirts and berets.
You know, Albert Einstein did the same thing. He said, I don't have to waste any brain cells on thinking about what to wear.
And Jamie is exactly the same. Very efficient kind of guy. Very pragmatic. Not surprising at all.
Hmm. I could get along with him.
Yeah.
This is David Levy, amateur astronomer, lover of the night sky, and comet discoverer. You are listening to Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
Now, Grant, what sort of tools do you use around the shop? I mean, in terms of computer and milling machines, or what is it you've got to work with for most of the myths?
It's interesting because most of the time, now at ILM, we would do a lot of the same type of work. You know, most of the time we're building something that's never been built before. You know, every model is different, every set is different, and they have different requirements. So we would generally use like mills and lathes, laser cutter, CNC machine, lots of tools like that. Here on MythBusters, we barely have time to wipe our noses between takes because we're moving so quickly. So any type of 3D modeling or CAD layout, that all goes out the window because you just don't have time to sit in front of the computer to figure all these things out and make sure you have your tolerances correct.
Good point.
So the most complicated it gets is like the Bridgeport mill. And that's for things that you can't do on, say, the drill press, or things that you can't instantly weld together. But everything else You know, it's lumber on a chop saw and welding steel, and that's pretty much as complicated as it gets. And then we have to, like, break it down and move on.
Well, we talked about the thought process, you know, that Jamie goes through and a lot of the engineering. What type of math is required to do that type of thing? Is that something you get involved in? Or, you know, I'm speaking for the younger listeners who may want to go into this kind of thing in the future.
Because it seems like whenever math's involved, they always look at you.
Yeah. Well, I think that responsibility falls on me because I'm the one that has the engineering degree. And so, you know, in terms of being able to figure out conversions between units and, you know, figuring out surface areas of things, that's the sort of thing that I have experience in. And so they say, oh, you know what, I think, Grant, you're going to have to figure this one out. But really, it does play a pretty big part in what we do every day, especially because doing what we do, we have all of these different units, things, the types of measurements that we're taking are sometimes like degrees Celsius, degrees Fahrenheit, angles. So there's actually quite a bit of math that goes into our everyday business here. And really, I get to do a lot of it, which is not bad, actually.
Yeah, you seem pretty like a natural with it.
Yeah, and it's fun to be able to predict, you know, oh, you know what? If I say, let's see here.
If you increase the counterweight, the car will fly farther.
Exactly. This is, okay, here's an example. I built a machine that would take a sword and swing it as fast as a human could.
Right. Loved that one.
And the myth is, can a sword cut a sword like they do in the movies? Like in Kill Bill, for example. So this machine, you know, I had to design it and get it to swing as fast as a human. So, which we used in that story, and, you know, okay, eventually bust of the myth, you can't do it. But we do this thing for the show called Revisits.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you okay, so that was busted, but, and then people, you know, get mad, oh, well, what about this? So, on that particular myth, people wrote in and said, well, yeah, okay, you can't cut a sword, but a lot of people heard that Japanese soldiers in World War II were cutting machine gun barrels with their swords.
Uh-oh.
So,
somebody raised the stakes on you.
Right. So, like, well, okay, get out the machine again and try it out and... without giving away the result, I tried it, and then I decided to ramp things up, which is another common thing we do here
sure.
on the show.
Is, you know, oh, yeah.
If you don't get the result perhaps you were expecting, well, what will it take to get that result? So now I'm thinking, okay, so I've got this machine, given the, and I used an air cylinder to pull a chain that swings the arm around. So I had to take that calculation, and of course I don't have it in front of me, but calculated a certain number of pounds of force in that pull. Like, well, you know what? I'm going to need more pull than that in order to, if I'm going to have any hope of trying to slice this machine gun barrel.
Right.
So I had to go and figure out, well, okay, how big of a cylinder am I going to need? How far does it have to pull? What's the stroke? And also, what variations do I have to make to the size of the sprocket that the chain is connected to swing the arm around to get it to maximum devastation?
A lot of stuff.
And so, yeah, used my math skill to calculate that out, and I think it's a very satisfying result for that show.
When are y'all revisiting that?
That should be up, I think, by December.
Okay.
If not late November.
Well, can you tell us any other myths that y'all maybe attacking, you know, coming up in upcoming shows? Because last time we had Adam on last year, and we were still seeing shows he talked about 6-8 months out almost. So can you give us a little scoop, maybe?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Coming up next, we have Gunslinger Myths, which is really cool.
Ah.
So, you know, like in the Old West, supposedly Kid Curry could take a silver dollar, put it on the back of his palm, turn his palm over, and before the silver dollar hit the ground, he could draw and fire his gun 5 times, emptying it.
Oh, wait, I've seen that guy. He is like in the 50s and 60s. Is that same guy?
This actually, Kid Curry is like super, like way Old West.
Okay.
Like Billy the Kid time.
1880s.
Okay. Sort of.
But there are modern day quick shooters who practice this art. So we explore that one. And by the way, he shoots 5 shots because supposedly in the Old West you only need 5.
Oh, right.
Instead of all 6 as a safety precaution, so you don't shoot your leg off or something. Can you shoot a silver dollar out of the air, as some were purported to be able to do? And what else? Oh, just like in the movies, can you shoot someone down from a hangman's noose? You know, saving, like, your buddy's
right.
Going to get unjustly hanged, and so you ride up with your rifle and shoot him down.
Wouldn't shooting the silver dollars be a federal offense for defacing public currency?
Yeah. Yeah, right.
I don't know. You know, well, I don't know. Maybe they're vintage money, so maybe they, because they're out of circulation.
Yeah.
Or you have to make fake money.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we do. We try not only silver dollars, but lead slugs, which are about the same size.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, you know, it's softer material.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one of the things also we have to do, is try and cover all of our bases.
Because people will call you out on it if they don't. If you don't.
Oh, they call us out all the time.
Yeah.
You MIT guys really tick me off.
It's amazing. And what I found out from this show is that everybody in the entire world is an expert in something.
Yeah, right.
And many times, those people will be the people who are so mad that they got their thing wrong that they will immediately turn off the show, find a computer, figure out how to log into the Discovery Channel website, create an account, figure out where to post, and then post subject lines like, wrong, wrong, wrongity, wrong.
That's how we get a lot of our listener feedback.
Yes, right.
So you know exactly how I feel. Yeah.
We have the same listeners and viewers, yeah.
Probably, yeah. wrong. You guys, right. Yeah, you guys suck. So, but yeah, that's what we have to.
This is John Chatterton from Deep Sea Detectives. You're with Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
I do have a suggested myth, however. Have you tried cow tipping?
Actually,
I've heard it. I've never actually seen it.
We Carrie and I do, as Adam and Jamie do, invited talks at colleges. We were recently at the University of Idaho at Moscow, and we didn't actually tip the cow. But we went to see a specific cow, which for agricultural research reasons, has had a window surgically implanted into its side. And you can actually, it looks like kind of one of those vacuum lock things, you can unscrew it, and
uh-huh.
Supposedly you can put your hand inside of the live cow to check something to do with the digestion. So we got very close to the cow.
Right.
We didn't open up the window because, you know, we were kind of, we had a show to do, and, you know, could have gotten messy. But
sure.
We did consider briefly attempting to tip some cows, but you know, we're on school property, and you know, we didn't have any beer.
Cruelty to animal. PETA would be on your case.
Yeah, so
come to Wisconsin. We've got plenty you can try.
Okay, there
you
go. Good. Yeah. We're outnumbered by cows too, so it probably would have been bad form. Yeah.
Now, if I ever see it on the show, I know where it came from.
Absolutely. Man. Heard it here first.
That's right.
Well, I have to ask you, do you listen to any podcasts?
No, as a matter of fact. I haven't gotten into that whole thing yet. But, you know, now that I'm on your show, I may have to start seeking these things out.
I know exactly where to start. You can start with ours. And
fantastic.
Come to the dark side.
That's right.
That's awesome.
Hey, Grant, I wanted to wish you a happy birthday. I know you've got one coming up later in October.
That's right, October 23rd.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Albie. 36.
He does age. Myth busted.
Yeah. I know, it's
that's
funny
the math.
Because a lot of people think that, you know, Tori and I in particular are very young. But, you know, we're both actually in our 30s. Our mid-30s.
Yeah. Well, you're in good company with me, man. Yeah. I'm 37, so.
I'm out of that league.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Chuck's way out of there. So what's next for you, Grant? What you got going on, coming up?
Let's see. Coming up right now, actually, what we're working on are Christmas myths for our Christmas special. So can you cook a turkey using a microwave radio antenna?
Wow.
Yeah. Will you break your toe if you drop a frozen turkey on it?
Ooh.
Yeah. More importantly, I
see ballistics gel experiments coming up.
I was hoping Buster was involved with that one.
Oh, yeah. No, it's ballistics gel feet. But more importantly, will it harm your pet? So that ought to shed some light on some subjects. We have a whole show dedicated to pirate myths. So going down the sail with you stab the sail with your knife and slide all the way down, like in the movies.
Uh-huh. There you go.
Yeah, Errol Flynn movies. Is the eye patch actually there to improve a pirate's night vision?
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
Night vision?
I heard that's why they do to change their depth of field, rather.
Uh-huh.
Is that right?
There's no depth perception with one eye.
Yeah, that's why they do that. So everything looks flat. And is that right? I don't know.
It's because usually if you're being attacked, it would probably be at night where you have cover of darkness. And if you're coming from, say, inside your cabin to fight on the outside, you could switch the eye patch to your other eye and you have instant night vision.
Oh, so it's not that they shot out. Or
yeah, it was to condition one of the eyes. When they flip it over at night, then it would be...
The pupil's already open.
Exactly. You're good to go. You're good to go immediately and fight. And if you were fighting against someone that didn't have that, you would have the advantage on them.
Hmm.
Interesting.
But all the pirates have one, so everybody had the advantage.
No. Yeah. I know, it's like, then it became a fashion statement, and, you know, everybody got one. Yeah. And stuff.
Yeah.
Images of Peter Sellers come to mind, I don't know why.
That's right.
Again, we really appreciate it, Grant. Thank you, and have a great birthday.
Well, thanks a lot, you guys. It was a lot of fun to talk to you, and I'm looking forward to hearing this podcast.
We'll let you know when it's online.
That's right. Thanks, Grant.
All right.
Thanks again.
Thanks.
Take care. And I'd like to thank you for listening to this special edition of Technorama. You can catch our regular show by going to iTunes under podcasts and searching for Technorama, or go to chuckchat.com/Technorama to listen directly from the website. There you'll find plenty of geek news, information, and other interviews such as this. If you want to get in touch with us, drop us an email at chuck@chuckchat.com or feel free to call the listener line at 206-222-CHAT. That's 206-222-2428. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, a binary high five. 101.